Tampa Tommy, come on down. You're the host of the Insurgent Radio Network, broadcasting live from the bunker in North Central Indiana, right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern, where the elite meet to eat, but mostly drink. Also nearby is Terrible Tommy's Weapons of Mass Destruction Used Equipment Yard, where you can purchase a freshly refurbished weapon of mass destruction for pennies on the dollar, if the price is right. You can reach Tom at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. Address your letters and mail to Tom Metzger, the Insurgent, just plain old box holder. Good old Tommy will get it.
Yes, you got it. Whoa, wait a minute. I'm way down here on volume. How about that? Let me get that up there a little bit for you. Let me see what's going on here. Okay. Let's see. We need a little more juice, man. More like that there. How about that? And we're back here in North Central Indiana. Still a little wet outside, but sun's out today. Gonna be a nice day out here in the countryside right next to Terrible Tommy's Terrible Tavern and Steakhouse, right next to our, well, about 3 miles from our P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show, for helping with the upkeep on the big giant website, and other little projects we've got going. We don't need a fortune, but we need a continuing support. And we want to thank all you radio subscribers that are loyal lone wolves. That's right. Without you, I just have to go sit in a coffee shop or a beer bar someplace. No, that's just too boring for old Tommy. Well, our old insurgent brothers are about ready to walk on into Baghdad. What's going to happen? Terrific. The insurgents. The other insurgents. They've been making damn good headway. Because they're better religious fanatics and more committed than the other side. I get them mixed up, the Sunnis and the Shiites. And I think it's the Sunni or the Shiites that are coming into town. I don't know. I get them mixed up. And I guess maybe it's the Sunnis that are going to try to stop it. I don't think that's going to last very long. So what's Obama going to do? He's sitting in there and say, Michelle, I got a hell of a problem here. Give me a cup of coffee and give me a couple of aspirin, man. I got some problems, man. Now I sent 200 Marines over there, and they want me to send the whole damn army. I want to send John McCain and all those guys over there. Let them protect the green zone. Yeah, that's what we want to do. So he's caught between a shit and a sweat, Obamsky. What do you think he's going to do? Well, he better not leave those Marines in there too long. He's going to sacrifice another 200 like Ronald Reagan did in that ship that got blasted here a few years ago. People forget about that stuff. And also that base down there, I think that was while Reagan was in control. The guy drove right in there with a big truck full of TNT and blew the damn thing sky high. I don't know, 200 or 300 Marines were killed there too. And then you got Benghazi. See, if they'd have just left old Gaddafi alone, everything would be fine. Leave the old Assad alone, everything would be fine. But this is still a part of that old regime change idea. It's like a domino effect. You know, it's like Tar Baby. Remember Uncle Remus? Yeah. The old fox is trying to get the rabbit. The rabbit sets up old Tar Baby. The fox gets out there, puts one paw on Tar Baby. It's stuck tight like super glue. Tries to get it loose. Takes the other paw, slaps him on there, the Tar Baby. Now he's got two paws he can't get loose. And then he hits him with a foot, and that sticks. Can't get that loose. And finally, the other foot can't get that loose. So finally, the fox is totally captured by the Tar Baby. And that is a hell of a good code to live by. And watch out. You think you got a weak adversary, and you take a slap at him, you get stuck on him. Pretty soon you're all stuck up. Well, we're, what, $2 trillion stuck up in Iraq? $2 trillion in that little country. The only thing, well, we haven't gotten anything out of it except dead GIs and dead white guys. But the big shots are getting some oil out of there, I guess. I hear there's a tanker out there with a million gallons of oil on it. That's sort of just sitting there, that Turkey's not claiming it, and the Kurds are not claiming it, and they're just sort of sitting there, and they're not, they all want it, but they're afraid to make a move to get it, just sort of floating around. I just hope no damn one of those drones don't come over there and sink the damn thing and ruin the ecology of the Straits. I believe it's in the Hormuz Straits. But it's crazy. It's crazy. I'm going to put old Max on here. You know. No, not our dog Max. Max Kaiser. Well, he had a pretty good show last night. I'll run you about 15 minutes of it and you can see what I'm talking about. We're living in a zoo. He knows it. I know it. You know it. Thousands, maybe millions of people know it. Well, you know, most of the resistance now is coming from Europe. Yeah, they got people coming out once a week and demonstrating like hell against the American Federal Reserve. Hundreds of young people coming out demonstrating against the Federal Reserve. That's great. I hope it spreads. We need to get that Occupy thing going. And we can't be too bashful about who we stand next to. You can stand there all day and say what you disagree on. But you got to come to some kind of decision on what you really, really, really disagree on. I was thinking of calling up old Mike Malloy, who don't know crap from apple butter about the situation with the white race or the working class whites. But anyhow, he does know a lot about environment and capitalism, all that kind of stuff. Let's go on down there to that damn George Bush ranch and start demonstrating. We need to get some real demonstrations going around these guys in Cheney's house. We're not going to check everybody's membership and what they believe in, what church they go to. Let's just get thousands of people. Because they're already afraid of being arrested. They are. And taken to The Hague. And there's a lot of young journalists, or at least a few, who got right in their face and say, are you ready to go to The Hague? You're a war criminal. Boy, that really upsets them, because normally everybody's around these guys like Kissinger And George Bush Jr. saying, "You're a wonderful guy. Can I have your autograph? Can I name my firstborn after you? You're such a wonderful peacemaker." Jesus Christ. How stupid. How utterly moronic can they get? I mean, you know, I see him bitching all over the internet about the neo-Nazis. How many real neo-Nazis are out there? And beyond that, how many neo-Nazis are doing anything? The system prays for a neo-Nazi biker or somebody to go out and kill somebody. Usually one person, lone person. And then you get weeks and weeks of this crap over the internet. Oh, how horrible, these neo-Nazis. They're even shouting "Puta" at the football games. It's horrible. Unbelievable. Now here the guys are making millions of dollars throwing a football or a basketball around. They're worried about being called Negra. You be Negra. Oh, that hurts my feelings, man. I only made $20 million last year, and you're hurting my feelings. I'm a dumbass nigger, can't even count, and I got 13 white bitches in my bed. You call me a nigger. Oh, no. No.
The Kaiser Report. I'm Max Kaiser. You know, Friedrich Nietzsche once said that the best weapon against an enemy is another enemy. But when your enemy is expensive oil, well, welcome to America's Middle East policy, where everyone is either an enemy or a frenemy. Stacey.
Max, the first headline I think is an enemy, not a frenemy, and that is ISIS stunner. Terrorist organization's annual reports unveiled reveal full investment highlights. Since 2012, the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, known as ISIS, has issued annual reports outlining in numerical and geographical detail its operations, the number of bombings, assassinations, checkpoints, suicide missions, cities taken over, and even apostates converted to the ISIS cause.
All right. Well, I mean, this is a perfect example of what we've been talking about. Capitalism has now become terrorism. And the so-called terrorists don't see themselves as any different than Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan or Monsanto or Exxon. They issue their annual reports, complete with infographics. They talk about various metrics and big data. And they're in the same business as Halliburton or Chevron. And they're competing with each other in this region of Iraq. They are become now the equivalent of a Goldman Sachs in the area. And we've been saying this for quite some time, that there really is no difference. They're cut from the same cloth, the terrorists and the bankers. They have the same mindset. They're both the jihadis. One follows Adam Smith. One follows the Quran. They're both ideologically willing to kill themselves and others for their belief. Using financial weapons of mass destruction or roadside bombs, it makes no difference.
Well, but that's kind of the foundation of all of our global trade and financial system is, you know, markets started back in the 1600s in the Netherlands, in Amsterdam, and why they were seeking funds to go off on their ships across the world and plunder other areas. Much like what the Somali pirates are doing, by the way, they also have basically a stock market at which to raise funds to invest in the next venture to go out and raid some ship. So here they're bragging about, you know, they had something they said that 10,000 operations in Iraq, 1,000 assassinations, 4,000 IEDs, 18 suicide bombings. And why they're doing this, apparently, is that ISIS's aim appears to be to demonstrate its record to potential donors, which means that the glossy excerpted pages shown above are indeed nothing more than investment highlights. And glossy pages, of course, are like the prospectus you're talking about. But what was shock and awe? but a weapons, selling weapons around the world. Because remember when America announced well ahead of time, they, you know, Fox News was preparing the population well ahead of time that here's coming a big film, feature film, shock and awe. Right after that, how many weapons did they sell? Billions of dollars of the same exact weapons to other nations who wanted a similar spectacular.
Yeah, shock and awe was a weapon show. And they, as a result, they've sold billions, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of weapons as a result of that show. You know, the ISIS annual report, as it is, or financial notes, I'd say this is a prelude now to an initial public offering. So I would imagine that Goldman Sachs or J.P. Morgan will take ISIS public. I've said it many times that Goldman, if they had the chance, they would have taken Auschwitz public back in the 30s. And I think that Goldman, given the chance now, would be more than happy to take ISIS public. They're the same people. Lloyd Blankfein and whoever's running ISIS are separated at birth, essentially. They are twins. They are ideological twins. They're willing to kill for a nickel. They believe they have some kind of ideological pretext for this, which is jihadi in temperament. Lloyd Blankfein is the Wall Street jihadi. Whoever runs ISIS is the Middle East jihadi type. But they're the same. Lloyd Blankfein is probably ISIS.
Well, actually, it started before 2003, before the Iraq invasion over in Jordan. They tried to overthrow Jordan. That didn't work. Then they went to Iraq after the U.S. overthrew Saddam Hussein. So they found some. Remember al-Zarqawi? That was him. This is his group originally. Then they rebranded. And now they're at war over branding with al-Qaeda. They don't like each other because now al-Zawahiri and the mountains of Pakistan is upset that these guys are getting more attention. So remember, in terms of enemies and enemies setting enemies against each other, this is a good for the conflict to keep the oil.
I've always said that 9/11 was a branding event. Think of it. For $500,000, they relaunched a jihadi brand. I mean, imagine if Nike, they would love to only spend $500,000 to launch a new shoe. But here, for $500K, they relaunched a 1,000-year-old dormant jihadi mentality, and as a branding event, it was the most cost-effective brand launch in history.
Now, of course, you could see the mentality of the sort of people around the world. So for the investors, the people who want to invest in this sort of thing, they need to show how many people they've decapitated and killed. For to attract new people to their cause, here are some of the headlines involving this. Is jihadists and their allies in Iraq and Syria are posting weird cat photos online. So here you see a kitty with a grenade. And here's a little kitty cat with a gun, some sort of 9mm or something.
Talk to Mark Zuckerberg about this. Kitty cat photos sell. He's worth $30 billion. ISIS knows that kitty cat photos sell. They should get evaluation based on the decapitations that you mentioned, the rate of decapitation, and the apostate conversion, which is another key metric similar to Facebook's likes. I would say that the valuation for ISIS right now would probably be somewhere in the $20 billion range. And I think that, you know, for a fee on banking fee, that's a pretty juicy fee.
So they're saying that ISIS is attracting so many people because of their social media outpouring, that they're good at...
The jihadis or the investors?
The jihadis, of course. Yeah, the investors don't care about that. They don't...
It's oversubscribed.
Yeah.
Try to do it on London, where there's a regulatory cesspool. So let's take ISIS public down there in the London Stock Exchange, and Mark Carney would be the first guy in line buying, you know, his allotment of these shares.
Next, I want to move on to, of course, what we talked about is why there are so many enemies and frenemies set against each other in the Middle East is, of course, about the oil. And energy, of course, is required to grow any economy. And in order to sustain the derivatives bubbles and Ponzi schemes around the world, we need energy. Well, half-price crude oil threatens Iraq breakup with Turkish help. A tanker containing 1 million barrels of crude oil is floating around the Mediterranean, and its cargo is available at half price. Yet, if any country seizes a bargain, it may be pushing Iraq closer to disintegration. So, the oil aboard this ship, Max, is at the center of a fight over its ownership between the semi-autonomous region of the Kurdistan, which pumped and shipped the crude from its territory in northern Iraq, and the central government in Baghdad, which claims the rights to all oil revenue. But because ISIS went up, you know, and was like taking city after city, the Kurds seized Kirkuk, which is a very oil-rich area, and they've now pumped some of that oil. They shipped it via Turkey, and it's sitting in a tanker, but now Iraq is saying that we own that oil. Kurdistan can't just sell it. So it's like, you know, it's an abandoned ship filled with a lot of oil out there in the Med.
Well, let's think about this now. So you've got 1 million barrels of oil on a ship with no flag, basically. So the price per this particular piece of business would have to be hedged with some clause that would guarantee warfare bombing. If we can, okay, so 1 million barrels of oil. So we can hedge this by selling, you know, oil futures to give us a nice guaranteed downside protection. Then I would take, let's say, $30,000 to bribe a drone operator, essentially, because they're all on the take, right, to bomb some key infrastructure to make sure that the price of oil doesn't go down, because that's the risk. The risk here is that you buy this tanker of 1 million barrels of oil, then suddenly peace breaks out.
They're offering it for half price. So if the barrel of oil right now in the world markets costs $107 or $114, depending on which benchmark you're using, they're offering it for $50. So anybody who's willing to take it...
is this the same group that's offering the bitcoins for the U.S. government on an auction? Which, by the way, I noticed they leaked out all the bidders on that particular piece of business.
So now, of course, there's all sorts of conflict in the area. Now, Kurdistan, and of course, the Kurds and the Turks have normally been not very happy with each other because the PKK in Turkey, and they don't like them. But Turkey's willing to do this deal because the Kurds are paying four times higher the fees to store oil in Turkey than the Iraqis are. So they're doing this deal over the money. But in terms of whoever buys this, even at a 50% discount, and I'm sure there's a lot of bankers on Wall Street, Paul Singer type guys who are willing to do this deal.
Yeah, you can lock in the price in the you know, futures market. So
yeah,
you're locking in that 50% gain. You know,
it's 50%. A guaranteed gain.
Yeah, but you still have, you know, risks on the price itself on the wholesale market. That's why I'm saying you've got to increase the hedge by buying off a drone operator to make sure there's enough unrest and panic around the world so that the price, and also to augment the price. I mean, obviously you want the price to go as high as it possibly can. So again, your downside, you know, the downside is very small here. You almost certainly are going to get a higher oil price, and you're going to double or triple your investment in a pretty short order. And get Warren Buffett involved. He loves these types of guaranteed profit plays. He's never worked a day in his life. He only, you know, picks up, you know, the free money that's given to him by these venal politicians. Get him on the horn. Get him on this deal. We broker the deal, and we could probably make a quick $5 million.
Okay, so let's go back to Iraq and what's happening there and all of our enemies and stuff. So if that tanker docks, Iraq's Kurdistan Regional Government will take an important step toward independence and hasten the breakup of Iraq. So this is what an analyst says over there at the Economic Policy Research Foundation in Ankara. So we could see the breakup of Iraq. But now, I want to go to one other story that is, this is a flashback to 2011, to point out that on our YouTube page, below this video right here is something that was hearkened to back in 2011. Revealed U.S. spy operation that manipulates social media. And this is from 17 March 2011. Military sock puppet software creates fake online identities to spread pro-American propaganda. And it's called Operation Earnest Voice. It was a $200 million deal to create these sock puppets. And speaking of how you offset costs and hedges, so $200 million went via. That's a kind of the level of sock puppets that America hires. So the Department of Defense, CENTCOM, gave $200 million to a California group to create sock puppets.
What I reckon
they did is went to Fiverr.com, Fiverr.com, spent $5 hiring people who are the lamest, because, you know, even the qualifications for this deal, I think we could sue the government to get this money back, because the qualifications are that the sock puppets should be able to pass sophisticated viewers, that they should believe that this is a real person. But clearly, they're not. Just look below. At least say something original. At least ISIS has little kitty cats and a grenade. You say nothing that is original. Nothing. It's like boring.
Well, sock puppets are undervalued. They're as cheap as that oil floating around the Med. I'd be a buyer of sock puppets. For sure.
Well, these ones are holy ones. Now, it's a part of a holy war, but they're holy socks.
Yeah.
Hi, the Pope, make me a saint. I'm a holy sock puppet.
No,
like
not
Tower of the Vatican. We got to go.
Not,
oh, you mean holes? They have holes in the sock. Oh, I thought you meant it was like they turn water into wine or something. Well, we got to go. So.
Well, there you go with... Slapsy Maxie. How about that? Pretty good stuff. They got it set up now like a corporation now, the ISIS guys, the insurgents east. Remember, we're the insurgents west. Well, not too far west. We're the insurgents midwest. How about that? I think I better patent that name, Insurgent Incorporated or something. I see a couple of other movie people I think have got a little dibs on Insurgent too. I guess they haven't noticed that I'm in the ball game. How about that? But anyhow, the guys, they went out and they studied the corporations and how the corporations operate. And they said, well, we can do that. The Somalians did it, but we'll do it better. We'll go out here and we'll get ourselves a little power, a lot of advertising, get on Facebook. And we'll start keeping books just like a regular corporation. And the more we conquer, we'll use that for advertising to get more investors. Hey, it's finally the military-industrial complex has got competitors. And they're in it for profit. They're not in it for religious purposes in fighting for the baby Jesus against the big old bad Muhammad. I see over there in Malaysia they're going to say that the Christian church tried to play a sneaky Pete on them and run in there and say, we want it in the law that we can refer to God as Allah, like the Muslims. Muslims said, I'm wise to that rise in your Levi's, man. You ain't getting away with that. He's ours. Allah's ours. We're going to trademark that name, man. You Christians are losing out, man. Now you want to use Allah, you know, to suck in more Muslim people out of Muslimism and into Christianism. And the courts in Malaysia said, no, you ain't going to do that. Oh, do you see where they're upset about some women got sterilized in the prison? They got sterilized in the prison. Well, now why would you have to sterilize women in a prison if they weren't pregnant when they went in? If they go in and they're not pregnant, why would you have to sterilize them? I think it's perfectly logical to sterilize incompetent super low IQ people, and guess who that is? And also, why should the state and the taxpayers have to pay for babies born out of some kind of a deal before they go into prison and get pregnant? I have no problem with that. No problem at all. Yep. Of course, guess who's doing all the bitching? You guessed it. All those Christians out there that don't want any abortion, but they don't want to have anything to do with raising the kids that don't get aborted, kids that nobody wants. As far as I'm concerned, if a mother does not desire to have a kid, why would you bring a kid into the world that's not going to be happy and going to be mistreated, maybe even killed by his own mother? Seems to me that abortion is the kindest thing you could do. So these Christians are such hypocrites. Now I see some of them are dragging these little niglet babies home. I was someplace over the weekend, I saw a white couple with this. They were just so proud. Their eyes were wide like that cartoon that Rockwell had one time. Their eyes were big and wide, you know. They had this little nigga baby, and they're so happy they're doing their thing. And look at us. We're doing our part to bring freedom and justice and wonderful things to the world. Yes, that's right. Now, I warned you about a week ago about this website, or they keep sending me stuff. Welcome to Before It's the News, top trending stories. You got to watch that. In fact, don't watch it. It's a false flag operation. It's an Alex Jones kind of operation. Oh, yeah, there may be some truth in some of the stories, but most of them are exaggerated or out and out lies. So stay away from that stuff. Of course, it's up to you. You want to read Alex Jones kind of material and get all excited and frustrated over crap. Well, it's up to you. Well, they finally got their way after stomping their feet and crying and moaning about my rights, mostly white people. Yeah, well, let me remind you that almost everything that really gets going in this country, as opposed to regular white working people and racial separatists, is generated by whites, not the blacks. On Monday, Duke University President Richard H. Broadhead, and I'll bet he's as white as the sheets that he sleeps on, announced to student leaders that Acock Hall, a building named in honor of white supremacist Charles Brantley Acock, will be renamed. Of course, they're doing this all over the South. The freshman dorm, which has been known as Acock Hall for over a century, will now go back to its original name of East Residence Hall, the name of the dorms back when Duke University was called Trinity College. The news of this campus update comes after years of student protest, right? Usually it's a half a dozen people that are spearheading that stuff. A Duke student government resolution which supports the name change. This was passed 6 months ago and was backed by the DSG as well as the Black Student Alliance, man. They don't want that name on there. The building was named early in the 20th century on one view of history. Well, how many views are there? And that view of history no longer prevails, unquote, Broadhead said. Well, stick around. It'll come back. Quote, given the circumstances, it seems a good time to change that name, unquote, so I can make all you niggas happy, all you white progressives happy, all you race mixers happy, and all you, especially all you kikes happy. Charles Brantley Acock was a leader of the white supremacy movement in the early 1900s when he was also a governor. In fact, he was known as the education governor, aimed to improve North Carolina's schools, which were then in a major decline. Well, don't give him any credit for that. By the end of his tenure, 690 new schools had been built, 599 for whites and 91 for blacks. But more so, when I was living in Florida for a while when I was a kid, in Zephyr Hills, Florida, there was a town about 20 miles, maybe 30 miles away called Dade City. And my parents used to go up there to shop and stuff in our old 37 Chevy. We go by this black school. And all I saw was new cars in the parking lot, almost a brand new school, painted all white and nice, principal standing out there on the front lawn with a suit on, nice suit, kids well-dressed and the whole bit. Well, the school I went to was okay, but it wasn't like that. It wasn't near as nice as the black school. And that was in 1949, I guess. So it had already started back then. And a lot of times they did, just to keep the blacks out of their hair, give them better stuff, better school, better buildings. But that wasn't good enough, because we want to be like the white man. We want to say we're equal to the white man. But more so, Aycock was known for his prominent role as a supremacy leader. Oh, well, that's end of the world. According to historians, during Aycock's term, this included mass violence as well as voter intimidation and fraud. Blacks were given literary tests prior to being allowed to vote. Well, why not? Why not give everybody a literary test? You know, that would be fair, huh? No, not fair. Well, it's ridiculous to vote anyhow, even back then. But anyhow, that was a big deal. Poor blacks had to take a test whether they knew in hell what country they were in or what state they were in or who in hell was running for office. Well, that's expecting too damn much. According to Vice President of Government Relations and Public Affairs, Michael Schoenfeld, ding, 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 Michael Schoenfeld, the name change is effective immediately, adding that when the class of 2018 receives their housing assignments this week, East Residence Hall will be listed rather than Aycock for the first time in more than 100 years. A plaque will also be placed in the entrance of the hallway detailing the name change and the history behind it, because Aycock was a horrible man. He liked white people. He believed white people were superior, which I used to think that too, but I don't know. Let's put it this way. Some white people are superior. Quote, we've given this careful thought. One argument is that history is history, and we can't change it by erasing, Broadhead said. Quote, but I don't regard this as an erasure. Oh, I see. In addition to the residence hall, Aycock's name is on multiple buildings on other campuses, including UNC Chapel Hill, East Carolina University, and the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. There's also, I marched in the streets of Greensboro one time with about 100 Klansmen, NS people, and a whole bunch of people. There's also, that was before the big shootout in Greensboro. There's also a statue of him in the Capitol Building's National Statuary Hall. Well, I've got to get rid of all that stuff. Currently, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill is petitioning to have a KKK leader's name removed from a school building last month. UNC Chapel Hill is one of the oldest public universities in the South. The campaign renamed Saunders, which also promoted the hashtag Kick Out the KKK, aimed to eliminate the name Saunders from a school building named after the KKK Grand Dragon, William L. Saunders. The school board's decision is still pending. Well, it don't make any difference what you do. It don't make any difference how many names you erase, how many flags you put out of existence. It's not going to change anything. The future is going to be more racist than the past. Take it to the bank. Well, well, well. Bernie Madoff's back in the news. You almost feel sorry for that bastard. Out of all the crooks on Wall Street, I mean, the super big ones, they only got him and a couple of others. Now they've got his former accountant, Paul Konigsberg. Bernard Madoff's former accountant pleaded guilty on Tuesday to aiding in Madoff's $17 billion fraud, Reuters reports. What about the others and their trillions of dollars in fraud? Goldman Sachs and all those guys. Oh, not supposed to talk about that, huh? Konigsberg, a former senior tax partner at Konigsberg Wolff & Company, admitted to one count of conspiracy and two counts of falsifying records of a broker-dealer. The 78-year-old accountant said he and employees of Madoff's firm manipulated customer account statements and filed tax returns based on manipulated statements, but maintained that he wasn't aware that Madoff's entire business was a fraudulent operation. Konigsberg now faces up to 20 years in prison. Well, that ought to do him in. Konigsberg is the 15th person to be convicted in connection with Madoff's fraud. In March, a federal jury convicted five of Madoff's former aides on charges of fraud and conspiracy. Madoff, 76, is serving a 150-year prison sentence after pleading guilty in 2009 to the largest Ponzi scheme in history. That reminds me of that joke. Where was it? I'm trying to remember. I forget who was in it now. I got a mental blank. But anyhow, this guy comes before the judge. The judge says, I'm sentencing you to 40 years at hard labor in the prison. And the defendant screaming and yelling, I can't do 40. I just can't do it. I can't do it. He goes on for a little bit. And then finally the judge says, well, do as much as you can. That was a funny scene from My Cousin Vinny, I think. You see, this is the way it works. If you steal enough money, Bernard Madoff, the convicted Ponzi schemer, currently serving a 150-year sentence at a medium security prison in Butner, North Carolina, doesn't much mind his surroundings. Quote, it's actually very pretty, unquote, he told the Politico reporter M.J. Lee in a 3-hour interview last week, likening the prison to a college campus. I bet there's a hell of a lot of guys doing time for just having a few marijuana cigarettes would like to go down to Butner. The interview, which was published today, offers insight into Madoff's life behind bars, as well as his health and his state of mind. He's being treated for kidney disease, but not cancer, he maintains, has been reported, and had a stent implanted after a heart attack late last year, which the government paid for. Quote, I'm on so much medication, heart, kidney, blood pressure, he said. I never took a pill before I came here. Anxiety medication. I must take 14 different meds every day, unquote. He's a bigger drug addict than the guys in a regular prison. Madoff visits a psychiatrist once a week, but said that those sessions have done little to prevent him from reliving the pain he's inflicted on his family. Quote, I can't tell you how many hours I spent with the psychiatrist to try to make some sort of peace with myself, to understand how I did it, he said. I'd like to believe that there was something mentally wrong with me. It would make me feel better. Well, there was nothing wrong with you. You're just a Jew. What? Don't you recognize that? His mindset, though, remains troubling. While seemingly contrite over his behavior 5 years ago, he admitted to running the largest Ponzi scheme in U.S. history, swindling friends and clients. Many of them were Jews, of course. An organization out of more than $20 billion, he claimed during the interview that he was responsible for efforts to recover funds after his arrest, arguing that Irving Picard, the trustee tasked with managing the recovery and distribution of lost investments, was trying to take all the credit. Even if he were involved in those efforts, which Politico says Picard's office denied, the decent thing would have been to keep his name far away from it, that he would insist on credit or some sort of public goodwill reveals him as a narcissistic and out of touch as he was 5 years ago. his penitent attitude is also less nuanced than it may first appear. Ask how he felt about the specific impact his fraud had on the Jewish community, both for the individuals and organizations that invested with him, many of which still haven't recovered. Madoff maintained his tribal innocence, insisting that his good deeds among the Jews outweighed his transgressions. Quote, "I don't feel any worse for a Jewish person than I do for a Catholic person," unquote, he said. "Religion had nothing to do with it." Well, of course it didn't. It was making power and money, for Christ's sake. That's all. But that's a pretty Jewish thing. Pressed on the issue, he said, quote, "I don't feel that I betrayed the Jews. I betrayed people," unquote. Before adding, quote, "I betrayed people that put trust in me. Certainly the Jewish community. I made more money for Jewish people and charities than I've lost." I'll bet you have. Oh boy, Bernie. You know, it'd be good to take all the guys that are in prison over minor drug charges and put them in places like Butner, and take all these high-rolling, corrupt, fraudulent Ponzi bastards and put them in high-security prisons. Or, like the Chinese, I'm pro-Chinese when it comes to if a CEO defrauds and screws enough people in China, they don't run them through court, or they don't run them very long through court. Take them out behind the factory and put a bullet right between their eyes. And I truly believe that's what needs to be done in this country, because it'll never change. These bastards will never change until they pay the price. And the word's out. Better not fuck around. They'll pull you out of there, take you outside the bank, put a bullet in your head. That is justice. Well, here's another one for you boys and girls to ponder. William Rapfogel, Jewish, the former CEO of Metropolitan Council on Jewish Poverty, who was arrested in September 2013 on charges of grand larceny and money laundering, pleaded guilty today in New York's State Supreme Court. The New York Times reports that Rapfogel, who led the organization for more than 20 years until getting fired in August 2013 during the investigation, admitted to stealing more than $7 million from poor Jews from the charity. Also charged with Rapfogel's predecessor at the council, David Cohen. He was arrested too. Who pleaded guilty today as well, suggesting that the fraud potential spanned decades. The scheme involved the Met Council's insurance company, Century Coverage Corporation, which would inflate the council's insurance rates by hundreds of thousands of dollars, which Rapfogel and his conspirators would then keep for themselves. Century's owner pleaded guilty to grand larceny, money laundering, and tax fraud in December 2013. The case has gotten increased attention due to Rapfogel's longtime ties to New York State Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver. Ding, 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 ding. Who Newsday reports was Rapfogel's youth basketball coach. Oh, isn't that sweet? I wonder if he pedophiled him. Rapfogel's wife, Judy, has served as Silver's chief of staff for many years. Silver has since distanced himself from Rapfogel. There you go, another Jew that you won't hear about on Fox TV, will you? Do you hear all this stuff on Fox TV? And you say the Jews are so secretive. Well, they are sometimes until they get caught, but Jewish fraud and crime is all over the news and internet, and they even talk about it themselves out of Israel and everything else. So this bullshit about the Jews being this total secret situation that nobody knows about, that's right-wing nonsense. Their crimes are right out in the open, at least sooner or later. Now, I hope you digested that show I ran yesterday on the Feelgood, Mr. Dr. Feelgood, because I think I'm the only guy that's promoted this for quite some time now, that Hitler, something went wrong in his brain, and it happened about the time of the Night of the Long Knives. He had just had this meeting with industrialist Thyssen on his ship in the North Sea, private meeting, where he agreed. Thyssen said, you can keep your SS for your own personal guard, but you got to get rid of the People's Army, which he agreed to. I think by that time, Hitler was on methamphetamines and other things, not only at first administered probably by this Jew boy, Jacobson, who was living in Berlin, or it was given to his doctor, Morrell, and he did it. And I think that addiction got so bad that it culminated in one of the biggest blunders that ever happened, and that was the attack on the Soviet Union. And, of course, you heard about the Kennedys were all into it, too. Almost got us into a nuclear war there with Soviet Russia. So it's amazing how many of these leaders and politicians are drug addicts, among other things. So that's a missing link, a missing piece in the puzzle of why Hitler went sort of national capitalist and turned his back on true national socialism. But, of course, they don't ever want to say much about that because that would make him a more sympathetic person, that he became an addict, and that would give him some excuse for some of the crazy things he did. So they don't want to talk about that. They want to, sooner or later, they'll have to do something about the Kennedy situation. But it's pretty much out in the open now, boys and girls. These powerful men, Churchill, Truman, they're all getting into this happy juice, methamphetamines, which was developed and invented there in Germany to keep their pilots awake, just like the truckers used to take bennies, not as strong of a portion as the methamphetamine, but I know when I used to be in California as a young man, we'd do a lot of partying. We'd take a couple of bennies before we go to work, and we'd work our ass off. Truck drivers, they were all taking bennies. A buddy of mine told me he was driving his semi, and he had been driving for days and days without a rest, staying awake with bennies, and he finally just collapsed over the wheel and ran his rig off the road. He's lucky he wasn't killed. Anyhow, I hope you guys understand that that's probably one of the biggest reasons for this narcissistic personality that developed in Hitler, and this bomb everybody, attack everybody, and so forth like that, of which, like I say, Churchill was taking the stuff too, and other world leaders. Anyhow, interesting. Well, since we're talking about Jews today, you know, we got two or three of them now on the Supreme Court, I guess two. And we've got this Kagan, who's new on the Supreme Court, relatively new. Today, in a 5-4 opinion, the Supreme Court upheld the right of the Greek town of Greece, New York, to begin monthly meetings with a prayer, ruling that the practice did not violate the Constitution's Establishment Clause. Proponents of the practice noted that the town had never discriminated between religions in selecting prayer leaders and allowed chaplains of all faiths and none to address the meetings. Opponents maintain, among other points, that the predominantly Christian character of the area resulted in a de facto establishment of Christianity through the practice, because nearly all chaplains available were Christian. In an opinion written by Justice Anthony Kennedy, the court sided with the town, stating, quote, "The town of Greece does not violate the First Amendment by opening its meetings with prayer that comports with other tradition and does not coerce participants of non-adherence," unquote. Well, I would disagree with that, because a lot of the crap they're going to say under cover of religion is bad history, out-and-out lies, and myth. And when you endorse that from the head of the group or the city council or whatever, you're endorsing out-and-out lies. Two of the justices in the minority authored dissents, one of them being Elena Kagan, who concludes hers with a fascinating and very Jewish rhetorical flourish. It also features a small mistake. After critiquing the arguments of the majority, Kagan closed with an appeal to her Jewish heritage. In 1790, George Washington traveled to Newport, Rhode Island, a longtime bastion of religious liberty and the home of the first community of American Jews. That's an oxymoron. Among the citizens he met there was Moses Seixas, one of the congregation's lay officials. The ensuing exchange between the two conveys, as well as anything I know, the promise this country makes to members of every religion, except the freedom from religion. Seixas wrote, first welcoming Washington to Newport, he spoke of a deep sense of gratitude for the new American government, a government which, to bigotry, gives no sanction, to persecution, no assistance, but generously affording to all liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. This, of course, is a mouthful of bullshit right there. Deeming everyone, or whatever nation, tongue, or language, equal parts in the great governmental machine. See, you see, it started way back then. You thought it was just... you thought this all just started. The first phrase there is more poetic. A government that, to bigotry, gives no sanction, to persecution, no assistance. Wow. Who judges what is bigotry and what is fact? What is bigotry and what is evidence? Oh, the usual suspects. But the second is actually the more startling and transformative. A government that, beyond not aiding persecution, grants immunities of citizenship to the Christian and the Jew alike and makes them equal parts of the whole country. There's that word again. Not aiding persecution, the government, are you kidding? The biggest persecutor in the world are governments. Washington responded to the very next day, like any successful politician. He appreciated a great line when he saw one, and knew to borrow it too. And so he repeated word after word, seeks his phrase, about neither sanctioning bigotry nor assisting persecution. I wonder if anybody reminded him of that when he marched out there under the Whiskey Rebellion to put the farmers down. The ink wasn't even... Well, I screwed up and ran out of time there, boys. I'll be back tomorrow on Thursday, and if I can remember, I'll read the rest of this to you. This is Terrible Tommy Off and Clear, 14-5, and just shut up. And don't worship a Constitution. Don't worship a Declaration of Independence. Don't worship a flag. Don't worship the spooks in the sky.